Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may find yourself today. We are the leaders of tomorrow, and to ensure we are well prepared, we need to engage each other in thoughtful conversation and build more empathetic understanding of our complex world. I'm your host, Charles, and you're listening to A Point of View. Our topic today is about technology and regulation. Here with me to discuss how we may facilitate useful digital technology while holding at bay harmful ones is Yazan Al-Assad. Yazan has experience in financial, regulatory, and investment environment, including the Central Bank of Jordan, commercial banks, law firms, private equity firms, and venture capital firms. He attended the Sabis International School of Shufa in Amman and Dubai before graduating from King's Academy in Jordan. Currently, Yazan is completing his last year of the Bachelor of International Economics program at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and is also interning as a private equity analyst at Forsen Group. Welcome and thank you for joining us today, Yazan. Like yourself, I'm super excited, really, at the potential of technology to improve our lives even more than it has to date. However, I can't, help but notice as I look around that the field of technology and at least how we're regulating it is changing. You look at the passage in Europe of general data protection rights. I think it's speaking to more constraints, perhaps, with what these tech companies can be doing. Can you walk us through, the kind of data we're actually talking about in the first place?
So the data in question is virtually infinite. Technically, there's no limit to what kind and or the amount of data tech companies can collect. And the reality is, the more the merrier. So it's just like research. The more data you have and the more detailed the data is and the larger your data set is, the more questions you can answer and the more detailed your answer can be. And most importantly, your answer becomes much more accurate. I think, it's the same with tech companies. So, for example, what advertisements should be on your account? The more data a tech company has, the better it can answer this question. And so it gets better at recommending to you and to people like you specific ads that you're more likely to click on. And you end up buying the product or the service. And that's how they're getting better at doing their job. In the real world, they can't collect infinite amount of data because it all has to be sorted or stored or analyzed. And, you have the processing power, data storage, and you have limitations in data analysis. They can limit what they can collect. But generally speaking, I would say it's much more than you and I can imagine. Even where you tap your finger on your iPhone screen can be collected. that's weird, but it's actually very, very useful to companies and even to users like me and you, right, when it comes to user interface or, user experience. The other day I was reading an article by Wired and it said, quote, "The puppy photos people upload train machines to be smarter. The questions they ask Google uncover humanity's deepest prejudices. And their location histories tell investors which stores attract the most shoppers. Even seemingly benign activities like staying in and watching a movie generate mountains of data, mountains of information, treasures to be scooped up later by businesses of all kinds," end quote. So even if you decide to sit in on a Friday night, watch a movie that's being collected, it gives me Black Mirror vibes. Am I right?
Definitely. I mean, I think it brings a lot of murky areas for us to be bearing in mind, particularly around data collection and the usage of it. Now, data ownership rights is an example that actually comes to mind. I think like many, in spite of the love and belief we have in technology's potential to make mankind's life better, it appears we need some framework when it comes to our data practices. What's maybe the best framework currently being discussed? I think data ethics, perhaps.
Yeah, so, data ethics are generally what's being discussed as some kind of set of principles regarding data or coding or algorithms. And, the thing is they encompass all things tech. So ideally, data ethics should answer lots of questions like what kind of data should be collected, why, how, when, where, for how long, how's it collected, stored, sorted, analyzed, deleted, used. And then also to in response to that, why, when, where, for how long, how can it be used, why, can it be sold? If so, to whom, how, why, at what cost? what exactly can be sold. It's just such a complicated question to answer, and there's so many sub-questions that arise. But let me put it simply, everything in the world has ethics. You know, you think about legal ethics, medical ethics, business ethics, food ethics, social ethics. Data ethics is just that, but in regards to data. And any of those categories of ethics I just mentioned, they differ from region to region, from culture to culture. But there are some that are shared across the globe. So in medical ethics, you know, the perspective on euthanasia differs across the world and across doctors. But the idea that a doctor's duty is to do all what he or she can to save a patient's life, that's not as controversial as euthanasia. But we have to remember that data ethics isn't legally binding, right? It's not a law that if you break it, or, you know, you're going to be penalized. And that's also another problem that arises.
For sure. So as you speak in there, I mean, I couldn't help but come to understand ethics is pretty much everywhere we look. But I still see some people asking, you know, why now? Do we have any insights on perhaps the rate at which data is being collected being a factor here?
My take is, you know, even if we don't know why we need ethics, ethics just emerge. Think of anything in life. There's always some kind of custom, you know, customs and traditions, behaviors or actions that are deemed acceptable or unacceptable. And it's, you know, the same with data ethics. You know, I don't think anyone is going to say, you know, it's ethical for a medical company to sell data to, you know, an e-pharma company or something like that, its client's data or whatever. In terms of why now, the sheer amount of data collection and the availability of data and what kind of data is being used and how we categorize it, how we use the data, it's really unprecedented and it's growing exponentially. And as it grows exponentially, I think it becomes much more important because it affects every single person in this world. I think it's much more important to start talking about that. You might ask, well, is this increased data efficiency a threat? Because on one hand, I'm not very comfortable with having my credit card password stored online, you know, even if it's on the cloud, even if it's encrypted. I'm not happy when my search history is used so that airline ticket prices jump when I look for flights. You know, I'm not happy with my search history being remembered on most things, especially when advertisements I don't want start appearing. I feel very uneasy when Instagram recommends, you know, someone I just met and didn't like on Instagram. They're like, you know, follow this person suggested. And I'm like, how did they know that I was in this area with this person? And that's super creepy, right? But then on the other side, you feel very happy when you're writing a last minute research essay that's due, you know, tomorrow morning and Google optimizes your search, you know, it uses your search history to optimize search results and gives you things that you really need for the essay. You know, maybe I met a pretty girl in person that day and I forgot to take her Instagram and it shows up suggested to follow this girl. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. How'd they know? That's great. It makes me feel happy. You know, that's really how it is. You know, when Google recommends a good restaurant, Netflix recommends a good show, those things make us very happy. So you have two sets of examples. One, people would refer to them as an invasion of privacy, and they're just like, look at how bad data is. And then on the other side, you have the sense where it's like, actually, knowing my search history, you know, it's very good. Data efficiency is amazing. You know, technology has made our lives easier. And you can think about things that don't impact us, you know, every single day, something like autonomous driving, right? Not extremely widespread, but how it uses data to reduce accidents. Think about medical technologies, how they utilize data to become more efficient, to become less error prone than human surgeons and surgeries. Think about utilizing big data in urban planning so that traffic lights can really improve traffic flow. They can optimize when to turn red or green to reduce travel times. How great are all of those examples? And then you want to think about how it's used to monitor people, to track every person's movement, you know, facial recognition list goes on. So I guess, as anything else in the world, data efficiency, it's not good or bad on its own. It's about how we use it.
I think it begs the question then of, assuming we're setting out a framework to manage the uses of this data, well, who's really going to be setting up this framework in the first place?
It's a great question. Who's going to make it, right? Who's going to make those laws, those regulations? Governments make the ultimate decision. And, you know, it's scary. It's also funny. I don't know if you guys have seen the Google and Facebook hearings in front of the Congress. You know, if you guys are ever bored, just YouTube, you know, Facebook, Google Congress hearings, and you know, it's a guaranteed laugh. It was really comedy. I think the questions were hilarious. But, you know, it also points to a bigger problem is that those are the people who are going to make the decisions and regulate technology, which is very dangerous. If I don't know how to, you know, if I don't understand technology, how am I going to make sure that technology is used in the best way possible and that consumers are protected? And, you know, that's very pessimistic of me, which I do not like. So I have some optimism. One, don't underestimate the power of people. I think in the long term, people and their movements have substantial impact. Think of the Arab Spring, of Black Lives Matter, the French Revolution, you know, think of Occupy Wall Street, think of the recent Reddit retail investor frenzy. You know, we might see something like this, people moving to tell governments, hey, this is what we want. Those, you know, our demands are as follows. Point number two, even if governments don't bring in the right regulations, I think trust is really important for technology companies. And if people don't trust the platform, they're not going to use it. If I don't trust Robinhood or Wealthsimple, I'm not going to put in my thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in that, right? I do not have $100,000. I'm just saying an example. You know, tech companies might be forced by customers to regulate themselves in a way that pleases their customers. You know, there's the other perspective that banks and tech companies are too large and important for us not to use them. And we do see scandals from banks and accounting firms. So I'll give you that. I don't know which one's right, but I think there's, you know, some middle ground, or the truth is somewhere in the middle. And the third point is, you know, governments make laws, but there has to come a generation of lawmakers who are tech-enabled, who are tech-literate. And so maybe not in the next decade, but I think things are going to get better, and I'm confident about that. And, you know, when we think about what kind of regulation we should expect, who should enforce it, will it be international or international or national? Today, you have this General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, that you mentioned earlier, which was released by the European Union in 2016 and implemented in 2018. You know, it's kind of the leading data regulation and privacy law in the world. I think it's driving a lot of the ideas about how to regulate data collection and usage, but there's still much more to be done. And then you have to also remember that although this is looked at as the global standard and, you know, it wasn't developed by the world, it was developed by the European Union. So it's also driven by politics, and its adoption can be very political. You know, it can depend on how your country's relationship is with the EU. And the thing is, we can dream of a world where data ethics and privacy laws are enforced equally and justly across the world. But, you know, there's not going to be one global law, I think, because the reality isn't as beautiful. We haven't been able to achieve a world in which all humans have the same rights everywhere, right? I'm talking about the most basic human rights, like the right to live. You know, poor and rich people don't have the same rights everywhere in the world. Male and female, people of different cultures, religions, you know, you name it. There's so much injustice and inequality in the world. And so it just doesn't seem reasonable to me that we can expect, if people don't have the same rights, same basic human rights everywhere in the world, I don't think everyone's going to have the same data rights. And I don't think that I can expect my data to be used the same way everywhere in the world. Even though technology goes across borders, and that's a very frequent argument, you know, technology affects everyone in the world. Why there should be one global law. And the thing is, you know, think about COVID-19 and the pandemic we're currently living. You know, it was really unreasonable for people to think that every country in the world would come together and cooperate and come up with, you know, regulations and travel restrictions together. It's just not the world we live in, because we have this global political nation state model. So each government will be, and you know, that's where, you know, in COVID-19, we're talking about life and death. So if you can't, I guess, cooperate and come up with one global law and something to do with life and death, then something as abstract as data is going to be much more of a challenge. So each government ends up being responsible for coming up with its own data ethics, you know, data and privacy laws, and they have to implement it. And, it's a really scary idea, because my data isn't going to be treated the same everywhere in the world. And, you know, technology companies operate across all jurisdictions, every country in the world almost, and my data is going to be spreading around. When I travel, my data is going to be spreading around, and it's not treated, I'm not entitled to the same protection everywhere in the world. But I think, you know, the upside is, as governments, you know, as people become more aware, governments at some point have to listen to people, even in countries that aren't democracies.
If we kind of bring ourselves together to make what would be considered like reactive regulation, I mean, I think it begs the question where we stand when it comes to preemptive regulation, right? I think you see the onrise of artificial intelligence now coming along. In your view, given your experiences, like, what do you think is a way we can approach regulation on innovation and technologies yet to be fully developed?
It's really a cool question. And I think, you know, people and governments often tend to be backwards looking, and regulation therefore ends up being reactive. And I don't want to criticize anyone. I don't want to criticize anyone because being forward looking, you know, understanding the complexities of the future and what the future might look like, that's really tough. There's this really cool article I read that compares what people in 1918 thought the world would look like in 2018, right? So 100 years later. And you know what? It's been, you know, we're done with 2018, so we can actually compare. Good thing they didn't make them expect what 2020 would look like. We would have got that done that way. And, you know, people back then weren't completely off. So, for example, people expected everyone to be able to own a vehicle, which is not completely true, but it is almost true, the idea of access to vehicles and how mainstream vehicles have become. People thought vehicles would look very different. People were right about, you know, the idea of TVs or colored photographs or broadcasting concerts and events. So now you guys are thinking, well, we did get everything right. You know, what's this guy's point? The idea is we actually focused a lot on hardware, not on software. So the complex human imagination couldn't really comprehend the data and the AI development we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. I mean, 100 years ago, people didn't really think data, AI, software, all those things would be how they are today. So mm-hmm. I don't think we can 100% of the time guess what life is going to look like. And that's the thing, that's why we see, I think, a lot of reactive regulation, and it's very hard to be preemptive. And, you know, when we look at AI, which is such a cool space, I really can't imagine the boundaries of artificial intelligence. Every day we build on previous inventions, ideas, theories, and discoveries to come up with new ones that expand our horizons. And so if there is no limitation to where we can go with AI and with data and technology and development, then how do we best think about regulation and come up with preemptive regulation? And so it's a very tough question. And to add to that complexity, AI isn't everything, right? People might think that AI is strictly, you know, in science or coding, but the truth is AI has applications in primary and secondary and services sectors and services, products, banking, finance, manufacturing, supply chains, logistics, economics, you know, just listening at this point, but sales forecasting, urban planning, you know, you name it, they have it. You know, you name it, there's an application of AI in that. Even in agriculture, right, something that we think about as a very primary sector, it has a lot of AI going on. And because AI is you know, a relatively new concept, and it's changing really quickly, and it's just such a massive concept with such a massive scope, regulation just is such a huge challenge. I think governments in general are just much slower than at acting and responding and thinking than the rate of change of technology. That doesn't mean that there's no regulation. You know, I'll start with an example that I think is very real world, and we're all exposed to it, you know, or we're going to be much more exposed to it in our day-to-day lives in the near future. Autonomous driving. How do you put autonomous vehicles on the road? How do you trust them? You know, who is liable in the case of an accident? Who and where should cars be tested? In different countries have different regulations. In South Korea, there is K-City, an unpopulated city where autonomous driving is tested. That's actually such a really cool idea. In Singapore, persons authorized to undertake trials or carry out such trials, they're required to obtain liability insurance for the entire duration of the trial or using the autonomous vehicle. In China, you need a temporary license plate. You know, a test driver has to always be there, a human driver to take control of things and to continuously monitor things. You know, AI also has applications in warfare and weaponry, and think about lethal autonomous weapon systems. It's this system that can independently search and engage with targets. So think about a machine making the decision on who to target in war, right? How to target them, what weaponry to use, what weapons to use, whether to abort a mission or not. And, you know, a big thing about AI is it doesn't really answer the why question, which in situations like this, you know, the why question is probably the most important one. The UN has been thinking about this since 2013, about how to regulate it, but there isn't really any strong kind of regulation. In 2018, China went to the UN and wanted to negotiate some kind of framework or guideline, basically some form of regulation to clarify what lethal autonomous weapons systems are. You know, it even called on, and I quote, all countries to exercise precaution and to refrain in particular from any indiscriminate use against civilians. End quote. And it goes on to express their concern on how those weapons are developed and how individual countries will explore those spaces and regulate. India mm-hmm. also called for a wait and watch approach. Think about how dangerous that is. You know, who are you waiting for, or what are you waiting for? The problem is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, how can you create global laws? That's really not how today's nation state order acts. So basically it goes back to individual governments. And as a government, if the country next to me is developing those kinds of autonomous weapons, I'm not going to say, you know what, no, I'm regulating autonomous weapons, or I'm banning it, or something along those lines. very scary, right? So I do paint a gloomy picture in this last example, but remember all the good examples I talked about, all the pros of AI. And, you know, I just want people to understand that AI is not inherently good or bad. AI is what people make of it.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Azan, for a thought-inspiring session. And to everyone else, we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. I will end it there, maybe give you the platform, anything you want to share with our audience.
I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope you guys, you know, can learn from, you know, what I said. I hope I've given you some kind of interesting perspective. You guys can count how many times I said, you know, during when I was talking, and, you know, you get a treat if you count it accurately. But I hope you guys really enjoyed it.